Welcome to Conversations at Mount Vernon's Washington Library. The Fred W. Smith National Library for the Study of George Washington at Mount Vernon serves as the premier resource for all who are interested in the study of George Washington and the Revolutionary and founding eras. Every year, the library hosts numerous scholars who share our dedication to generate and disseminate new knowledge about all things Washington. The library's founding director, Dr. Douglas Bradburn, has the opportunity to sit down with these scholars to explore their research, and we are so excited to share those conversations with you. Today's guests are Dr. Annette Gordon Reed and Dr. Peter Onuf. Dr. Gordon Reed is Professor of History and Charles Warren Professor of the American Legal History at Harvard. Dr. Onuf is Thomas Jefferson Memorial Foundation Professor Emeritus at the University of Virginia, where he taught for more than 20 years. They are here to discuss their joint book, Most Blessed of the Patriarchs, Thomas Jefferson and the Empire of the Imagination. You'll hear how Jefferson came to view himself as a patriarch throughout his life, as well as his thoughts on slavery and faith. And now, Drs. Gordon Reed, Onuf, and Bradburn.
Study of George Washington at Mount Vernon. Here I am joined by two of the brilliant minds of early American history. They've heard so many things about themselves recently about how great they are. And here they are.
Oh, more, I've but ignore.
More, exactly. I mean, they're famous for historians. I mean, they're not Miley Cyrus famous, but they're pretty famous. Annette Gordon Reed, of course, Professor of History, Charles Warren Professor of American Legal History at Harvard, the Carol Forsheimer Professor of Radcliffe Institute of Advanced Study at Harvard. Brilliant studies of many different things, but particularly the Hemingses of Monticello, which won the Pulitzer and the National Book Award. And although it's not listed on her bio in the back of this book, the George Washington Book Prize, which is the most important prize.
Well, what can I say? I cherished it. I love that view.
Yeah, that's right. Well, the medal. Do you wear the medal every day?
The medal's pretty heavy.
It's pretty cool. So,
but I do have it in a very visible place.
Yeah. Well, I didn't know she was into heavy metal.
A brilliant study.
Quit it.
So Annette is most famously known then for kind of giving us the private life of Jefferson and Sally Hemings, finally taking her story legitimately and giving it the same kind of attention that the great sage of Monticello has always gotten, and in doing so, revealing a completely new way to understand both of them and early American history. Now, Peter Onuf is more known for thinking about the public side of George Washington. Thomas Jefferson's world, and he's been the Thomas Jefferson Memorial Foundation professor at UVA for many years now. He's emeritus, but he's probably better known to anybody on this audience as the 18th century guy in the Backstory radio show and podcast, right. Backstory. And Peter has been a great guide to many early Americanists on how to write about the history of the founding era with intelligence and with integrity, and I'm delighted to have him here. Peter.
Thanks, Doug. Great to be here.
Good to be here.
So we're here at Mount Vernon. You guys are obsessed with Thomas Jefferson. What's it like to spend a Jeffersonian generation thinking about that man? How are you guys doing?
Well, it's been more than that, Doug.
Yeah.
Well,
this was only 19 years, and it's been
I keep thinking that I've written my last Jefferson book. Mm-hmm. But he is always returns. I wrote a book with my brother that was supposed to be about something else completely, and there's a Jefferson chapter. It just erupts, the return of the repressed. I thought I was truly done probably writing any books until Annette came along.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, the second time I came along, when I came along and asked
him. Oh, no, you've been along.
I've been along a long time. But I asked him to write a book with me because I am thinking about it. I have a contract. I'm doing more than thinking about it. To do a two-volume biography of Jefferson. And I thought this would be sort of a nice warm-up. Mm. We could talk about the stuff that Peter has focused on, the mind of Thomas Jefferson, and look at him from a different perspective. So it's been an interesting trip.
Now, okay, so let's pause for a moment. So a two-volume biography of Jefferson, is this the first volume?
No.
Okay,
No. This two-volume would be sort of like a soup-to-nuts thing. Right. I'm not going to go six volumes.
I always want to ask you, what do you mean by nuts?
Yeah,
that he ends up crazy or what?
He does end up a little crazy. We'll get to that. He ends up a little crazy. Come on. But yeah, Soup to Nuts. So
No, at least you didn't do that in public. Thank you.
So
as if this is not public.
Dumas Malone needs to be replaced.
Well, not replaced, but he needs to be updated.
People don't write multi-volume biographies. This isn't the 19th century or the late 20th century. Annette, what are you thinking of this?
It's just too much stuff there to do it in one volume. Yeah. I mean, John Meacham did a very, very good job, but there are just some really serious issues. Jefferson at the plantation. It's just too much stuff there to do it all in one volume and do justice to all the really important things that are part of his life.
Yeah, I mean, with him, I think with Washington as well, like trying to do a one-volume biography and just cover sort of the public life is almost impossible to make it coherent. It just becomes a list of famously one damn thing after another rather than any kind of,
in the army and then, the Revolutionary War and all of this. Each one of those could have it, but, you don't want to be Flexner, but you want to...
That's right.
Well, I've never been interested in biography, and that's one of the big differences, because I think all of Annette's work has brilliantly given us a portrait of Jefferson.
Beings.
Yeah. I always thought Jefferson was interesting because he's an entry point into all kinds of other stuff that I am interested in. So for me, it's been a discovery of the interest I have discovered in myself working with Annette on figuring out how this guy ticks and how the ideas that I specialize in, well, they might matter to him personally.
How you can connect the mind to the body. That seems to be what
you guys are trying to do. That is the
theme of the book. That's the theme of the book, really.
Is it really? Look at that. I captured the theme.
I know, That's part of it. Yeah, that's a big part of it. How do you put those two things together? Because, when you pull them apart and you compartmentalize them, one of the things I said is we had the era of the sort of great man Jefferson biography. Then we went to the era of Jefferson and. Jefferson and slavery, Jefferson and this, that, and the other, and he gets fractured. And people are looking at all these various points and saying, well, wait a minute, how does this part talk to the other part or whatever? And what we'd like to do is to try to put him back together, to get out of that era and back to a point where you're seriously thinking about him, the man whole.
Put him in his context.
And I was going to say, historicize is the technical word.
Exactly.
Well, you're an expert. So here's the thing. When I think of the general public and their attitudes towards Jefferson right now, I think it's still heavily influenced, when it's not overtly negative, it's still heavily influenced by Joe Ellis's Sphinx book. I know this is going to give Peter conniptions here, but the point I mean is Joe Ellis's basic thesis, right, is he's like, if he's a river, he's the Danube. If he's the Sphinx, if he's a monument, he's the Sphinx. If he's a painting, he's the Mona Lisa. He's just too impossible to understand. And you guys seem to be directly writing against that notion of a confusing, conflicted Jefferson.
Yeah, I would say so. We think that he is as coherent as any other human being, intelligent person would be. I mean, he's not a simpleton. He wasn't, so it's not anything like that. But he's intelligible if you take him as, he presents himself. And one of the things we say in the preface is that we try, whenever it is all reasonable to do so, with that caveat, to take him at his word. When he says he believes something or he thinks something is going to happen, and the response has been this sort of hypocrisy notion, you didn't really mean that. We got you. We understand you. And it's about the person saying how much they know as opposed to what they think is going on with him. Yeah. And we thought, it's time. Hey, why don't the generation of people be introduced to somebody, to what he actually thought about what he was doing and not what everybody has sort of said he was doing.
I think there's actually a surplus of coherence, if that's possible.
And you would wish he would be a little less.
Sometimes.
Sometimes.
And what I mean by that is he's self-conscious. And one of the themes of the book is Jeffersonian self-fashioning.
Yeah.
And that's always with reference to audiences. So it's his lifelong effort to find a place for himself in his world. That's why I think you really need to know his world well. And I think also, conversely, you get to know his world a little bit better once you studied him.
Exactly.
But you don't think, you're not describing just a pose. You're not revealing a pose for history that he's making. You're trying to get at really how he understood his place in his
world.
And his sense of responsibility about the world. And it's sort of, aggrandized. it's a grand vision of what he's supposed to be doing, but it's not a pose. It's a real sense of, okay, I have these abilities, I have these opportunities, and here is how I'm going to be do it. And so here's how I'm going to do things. So he thought about it, and he acted.
Yeah. I think nowadays, actually, we cultivate notions of many roles, multiple personae, because we have a very fragmented sense of the way we actually live our lives.
Mm-hmm.
For him, I think there's a real effort to make it all fit together. One of the chapters that we enjoyed most, and about which I'm most ignorant, is music.
Mm.
Because I think you'd say, oh, well, now we're getting into hobbies. Mm-hmm. That's where it would be on your CV. Do you have hobbies on your CV?
No, I should, though.
No, I don't think so.
Fascinating.
Maybe if you were applying to be an undergraduate at an elite institution.
Tell us all about your hobbies. But music is there. But there's a personal component to it. But it fits into his worldview, and you can see how it fits into his worldview. It's not a frivolous thing at all.
All right, well, let's get to the worldview then. I mean, the two themes that you're playing with in the book seems to me, seem to me, it's in the title. Patriarch.
Well done.
Patriarch and patriot.
Looking for this kind of
patriarch and patriot. These kind of two, these two dynamic understandings of himself.
We played with that a little bit.
I was wondering. Yeah, patriot and patriot could have been the title, but the most blessed of the patriarch's quote is was that, did that immediately emerge for you all when you found your unifying theme?
Pretty early on,
the letter to Angelica Church, in which he describes.
Who's famous now?
Yeah. I know, this one of the Schuyler sisters.
Right.
You know, she's Beyonce on the at halftime. You know, have you seen that little gif that people do with? It doesn't matter. But
I haven't seen it yet. No,
I'll show it to you
Beyonce
after. But
she's stepping out.
and Peggy. You know, at the end.
Oh, yeah.
No, she's very, very. Famous now, and that's good, you know, because people will know who we're talking about when we say it. If we said this witness last year, nobody would have had any.
That?
How do we anticipate this? This was years ago.
Years ago, we
decided that letter was a key to him, talking about describing himself as blessed, as the most blessed of the patriarchs.
Mm.
And then Cinder Stanton picked up on another part of that in her book, Those Who Labor for My Happiness. And he's telling Church that he's about to leave, you know, after Hamilton has sort of beat him up. And he's going to go home, and he'll, you know, his fields to farm and to watch for the
peace
happiness
for
days.
For him.
Peace, finally.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And he will be the patriarch of this vast domain.
Yeah. So the patriarch, family, home, these are crucial things that you think matter to Jefferson more than anybody's really.
In two ways. One, he has this ideal vision of home and mostly cultivated at a distance, and that leads to the second point, and that is home is both a place to be and a place to think about. So it has that doubleness. Mm-hmm. And so it's not that he goes there and becomes the real Jefferson because he's in the bosom of his family. That's what he would tell his daughters, for instance. Mm-hmm. This is where we don't have the jarring and the conflicts of political life. I can be at ease. This is where I'm really myself. But of course, this is where we indulge in a little modest psychologizing. It's modest. There's no coherent analytical approach here. But he's protesting too much, and Annette particularly is focused on this. Why does he have to keep assuring people in his family, especially when Patsy, his daughter, complains after he's been home enjoying his family for a period and hasn't had a chance to talk to his own daughter because of all the Pauls are there. So that is, you might say, a threshold of our interpretation is, as we enter the house of Jefferson, what is all this talk about? And it's not that he's insincere. I think that's the point. But I think a fair reading that's not tendentious, we're not making an argument about him, against him, I should say, or for him, but just trying to understand the guy. What do you obsess on? And what does it mean that you obsess? Have you shared your concerns with your therapist? What does your therapist say?
Yeah.
And why he has this vision. One of the reasons he has his visions is that he's not at home very much. One of the things we talk about is people think of him in terms of Monticello, but he spent half of his life, his adult life, away from there. And you know, the people who are enslaved at the plantation live there, you know, more consistently than he does. It is their place, you know, in a physical way, than more than it is his. But he's always leaving home.
Yeah.
Leaves home as a little boy to go to Shadwell, goes to boarding school, then William and Mary, and then, you know, he's 10 years with his wife in a place, but he spends part of that. They're still building Monticello. a good part of that is at Elk Hill with her, her husband, her first husband's home. And then he goes to France after she dies, and then he's in politics. So there's a home. He's always, you know, he's an idealized vision of this place with these people, with a kind of family that he never really had.
Yeah, he has a rough time of it with death and loss and, and dysfunction. And you very nicely, I mean, what you guys really nicely do from my perspective and sort of a lot of Jefferson books is the awareness of how people change over time is crucial here. I mean, we'll talk about it, but the trip to France is a pivotal point. Rethinking or reimagining his empire.
Well, it's, you know, it's really interesting because even though the book doesn't proceed chronologically, we try to pay attention to chronology. And that's one of the, been one of my pet peeves about writing about Jefferson. People will take something that happened in 1824 you know, or look back to something
in mind, right?
or take something that happened in 1794 and explain something that happened in 1824. Or Jefferson is, you know, the story that he is, you know, he doesn't understand women, or he has a, he's uncomfortable around women. They'll talk about Rebecca Burrell. He's 20. I mean, who wants to be to be judged by how they were when you're 20 years old? Exactly. You can't. You just sort of string these things together to try to suggest that there's sort of coherence over time.
I think one of the most remarkable areas where there is this fallacy of the timeless mind, and I'll admit that I was prone to this myself, or have been, is on slavery. Because we assume, okay, he laid it out, and one of the reasons, again, is he tells us he never changes his mind, right?
And we don't, and we believe
think
it.
They don't. As well, I mean, some of us deceive ourselves, and we believe that, well, this is always what I thought.
I've
unless you keep
this,
it in a dear diary, like, oh, I didn't realize I was such a horrible person at one point. The trajectory with Jefferson seems to be the trajectory that a modern audience wouldn't want to see, which seems radical. We'll talk a little bit about how do his ideas about slavery as an institution, as it relates to his life, how do they change over time?
Well, he starts out, as you said, a person who is of a class of people that accept slavery. That's a natural part of their lives, and then he begins to question that. In his commonplace books, he writes down this an inscription for an African slave, a poem that's talking about people ripped from their homeland and, you know, by a cruel tyrant forced to do all these kinds of things. The words that sort of echo what he says in the excise part of the Declaration. I mean, he's in his 20s. This is his vision, you know, of what it means, you know, against the slave trade. Now, we look at that now and say, well, you know, they're just trying to, that's not an anti-slavery measure, and it turns out not to be. But in his 20s, he actually thought it was. This was like a person who's a liberal and progressive who thinks, well, in order to be that, I have to believe this, 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 you know, questioning the church or religion, all those kinds of things.
Yeah, there's an awakening, a questioning, excitement there in the revolutionary moment.
And even before that, David Koenig is writing a really important book about Jefferson and the law, and he's been arguing to us, and we've actually had big fights about it, that Jefferson was seriously engaged with the problem of slavery as a young...
As a lawyer.
Yeah, he has that famous case with Wythe, right? I mean, where they're operating different sides, and Jefferson's using a natural law sort of justification, ending slavery.
And this is a good example of how we customarily think of Jefferson, because he tells us in 1814, when he writes to Edward Coles, that in colonial days, we never thought of slaves as human beings, that they were like cattle.
Right.
And then he has his Enlightenment epiphany. And that's all you need to know, because once he's realized that we're dealing with real human beings unjustly held in bondage, then that's what he holds true to the end of his life. But it's a lot more complicated than that.
So what happens in France?
What happened in France is he goes there, and, you know, he's left in sort of a, you know, bad humor about Virginia. He's got worked
bad
over.
Bad time as governor.
Bad time as governor. Wife dies. Just a disaster. And he's anxious to get out of there. And he's been writing notes on the state of Virginia. He's been very, very critical of Virginia, the state of Virginia, talking about the Constitution, all the things that they're not doing and haven't done and are not likely to do. And he gets to France, and there's some things about it that he loves. The music, the architecture, the food, all those kinds of things. The culture, high culture. But there's some things that terrify him. Family life, women, you know, out in the streets, women engaged in politics. And he also sees the peasantry, the kind of, you know, the story they tell about, you know, coming from Le Havre, and they, when they're going to the hotel, Martha talks about the beggars you know, just people just grasping at them everywhere. This is shocking to him, and probably shocking because they're white people. They're people who are not, you know, they're Europeans who are in this really, really degraded state. And
this real gulf between rich and poor.
Huge gulf. Unimaginable. I mean, you know, the place where, you know, James Hemings worked, Chantilly, the chateau. I mean, it makes Monticello could be a tool shed compared to that. It's just not even close in terms of the scale of it. Mm-hmm. And it horrifies him. Mm-hmm. And he begins to think about, you know, what could be done to alleviate that, and also how much better. He's convinced that you'd never see this kind of stuff in America.
Mm. You know, he writes that letter to Thomas Cooper, I don't know what year it is, maybe 1810 or something, this is after he's retired, and it's a comparative happiness letter about, where are people happy?
Who are the happiest?
And he clearly is including enslaved people in his accounting of the quantum of happiness in the United States as opposed to any European country.
Yeah. Happiness where people are with their families, happiness where people are multiplying, having children, that's, you know, so that's a good state. He's measuring these things in a social life in a way.
Well, that's fascinating in and of itself. We do have these polls now, which country is happier than others. But in that period in France, he has a great letter to Washington in which Washington's sort of trying to get his views on the Society of Cincinnati, and Jefferson writes him that letter in which he says, he talks about 23 out of 24 people are living in poverty, and that I had these views, I didn't have these views when I had only American ideas only, that he now is seeing what could happen if you establish this hereditary organization, the Society of Cincinnati, and how it's going to change society. 100 years from now, we're going to be like France.
You see the doubleness of this, because on the one hand, it reinforces his convictions as a Republican. This is it. This is not just my fantasy, it's the real deal. Yet at the same time, it leads to a kind of baseline complacency with the way things are.
It's just taken them 1,000 years to get to a point where it's taken them 1,000 years to get to pre-revolutionary France, which he's all for. And he said, well, we could take time too. You know, eventually there will be the light of progress if we get rid of the priests and priestcraft and blah, 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 and all this kind of stuff, that eventually people will become enlightened. And the other problems all the problems that we want to be solved, will be solved, including slavery. And that's the cop-out from our perspective. You know, we should be out there doing stuff. But once he sees another society that there's tremendous suffering, sees and makes the comparison, he does become complacent. And he comes back, comes to Washington's cabinet, focuses in on building the United States of America, and this problem will solve itself. Of course, we know that's...
And one of the things
wait a second, though. I mean, you guys, that's a little... Isn't that too easy? I mean, doesn't he write...
Well, it's a podcast. We're trying to...
Push us.
Is the question. I guess, so he hates artificial distinctions, you know, things that will lead to the priestcraft, these things that human society is artificially created. But to what extent does he believe that Africans are naturally slaves? So that in that sense, it's not an artificial, but a natural system.
No, he doesn't believe that.
He doesn't put that in the notes?
No.
No, he does not.
He doesn't.
You guys might know more than
Doug,
doesn't say Africans are natural slaves in this way.
You could say is the ideas that suggest scientific
racism. Yeah.
But that's not the same thing. It's being saying that Africans could be slaves. They could be they could be their own people in their own country, subpar people in their own country, but not that they should be slaves.
Right. The moral philosophy of the Scottish Enlightenment was really important to him, and he would never deny the moral sense in enslaved people. For him, that's what makes people equal. The question is, is there something we can do about the problem of slavery?
Right.
And as you know, his solution is global. It's collective. We have to take this enslaved people and put them someplace else, expatriation, or what we now usually call deportation. So you could say, well, God, this is really ugly, because he's rejecting the notion of a kind of a capacious multiracial republic. And if democracy is so great, can it accommodate difference? The answer at this period would be no.
Yeah, but in a spectrum of opinion, he's not, it's not like he's way retrograde on these issues.
No, not at all. Because
people saying multiracial democracy is
great exactly. 1790. I mean, the 1790s and even the 19th century, the answer was internal exile. You know, we'll have two countries. We'll have, you on one part of town and me on another, not in another country, But you still have, you're here, but second-class citizens, and physically separated from whites.
And one thing we don't appreciate now is the idea, which is pretty radical in its own time, that you could have a society of equals, and that is abolish classes or status groups. That is, we think those are trivial, insignificant distinctions, but they were everything in the old regime.
Oh, well, absolutely.
Well, I think we also downplay religious, the separation of church and state. Obviously, it's a big part of what we talk about and what's significant, but it really is a radical thing to try to achieve that society.
And it might be a good idea to keep some balance on all this, because it's clear by our standard, the thing that matters most to us, the American dilemma, he's a ghastly failure, and why didn't he know he would be a failure?
Right.
And the real question, and we would never challenge this question, it's a good one, why don't you know by the end of your life that it's not working out? The younger generation is not prepared to do what you couldn't do. Instead, just look at the price of slaves, Mr. Jefferson.
But that would be a sort of a negation of all that he had believed for his entire life. The progress, we know better than to think that progress is something that you just sort of a linear thing and you're getting better and better and better. And he didn't believe that. I mean, he believed that. We don't think that.
He's a progressive.
But he believed that. He's a progressive. And he thinks.
A real progressive.
Well, he has a progressive philosophy of history, in the sense.
Now,
the
things are going to get better. And so evidence that it's not going to happen, that these people are going backwards, he's going to say, well, maybe that's a glitch, or maybe these are people. But if they see the light, if, this thing or other thing happens, but inevitably, it's going to get better and better and better.
And that's why we make a big deal about religion in this book.
Yeah. Yes,
Jefferson's faith, because Jefferson doesn't make any sense without faith.
We'll talk about that. I mean, Jefferson at prayer. I mean, what is Jefferson and religion is a great topic. It's been written about by many, many people, obviously. And, I listened to you all talk to John Fea and his podcast, but he didn't talk about religion. Only mentioned that chapter, and he'd be the guy to have the conversation
with you.
But he copped out.
What is this competitive?
Absolutely right. So
John, we love you.
So
we all
love John. And you should listen to the John and Doug episode of this podcast. But so take me through the religion story in Jefferson. What do we need to know about him?
Well, I think the big thing is it's very hard for us to avoid the modern binary between Christianity as understood by evangelicals and its absolute negation, which is secular humanism. That blinds us, even those of us who don't locate ourselves on one extreme or the other, to the kind of faith that Jefferson might have. It seems to me that Jefferson was astonished at the wonder, was awestruck at nature. And nature had an intelligent design. There had to be a creator. His deism sustains a sense of wonder. You could say that his being scientific or a natural philosopher who wants to understand the workings of nature, what laws govern it, that is a kind of worship. And I think we sell this short if we say that's disenchanted, that's the end of faith. Because the faith, and this is, I think, gets back to our point about slavery and the fulfillment of his dreams for the Republic, it has to happen. Well, it has to happen for the same reason that the cosmos, the creation, has to make sense. And those are part and parcel of the same thing. So if you can't understand or grasp his faith, the leap he takes, and it's as big a leap as any believer. In fact, it's bigger, because most people will be seduced by the wiles of priests and will accept magic. Will accept authority, because that's what really bothers him about organized religion, is the assertion of some kind of divinely sanctioned authority, which is to deprive you of your autonomy. Mm. And he says John Calvin is the biggest atheist going.
Mm. John Calvin, who has replaced him, I guess, in Texas, in the Texas history books, textbooks, as an exemplar of the Enlightenment. It is something that's difficult to come to grips with, because people have written a lot about Jefferson, but the sort of common view of him is in this sort of binary. There are people who say he's an atheist. Yeah. There are a smaller group of people who sort of make him an evangelical, which
that's
is,
happened.
That's happened, but which is sort of difficult to understand. But and we talked about this. We've talked before about our differences and how this was one point along our collaboration that was somewhat difficult because
I wanted to talk about that. We're going.
But I mean, I
prayed.
You prayed. He prayed. prayed in his Unitarian, last Unitarian sort of way.
Yeah, is this Peter Onan reading Jefferson as Peter Onan?
That's all
the question. Everybody's going to be a Unitarian in a generation.
You know, I'm a Methodist, and so a United Methodist. I am that tradition, and I'm culturally a Methodist or whatever. So, I mean, I had sort of ideas about what it takes to be a Christian, and he didn't sort of measure up. Jefferson didn't measure up, and he convinced me that I was being I'm just being prejudicial. Yeah. You know, I'm prejudiced. I was sort of giving, setting up a litmus test.
Well, and
the fact is that these are contested issues. There was a council. People said, this is in, this is out, and people have contested that over centuries. So, who am I to say if you believe that you are a Christian, that you're a follower of Jesus, and this is your understanding of religion, and you think that other people have added stuff that he didn't say. He never claimed to do. I don't have the authority and the power to say that, wave my wand and say, no, you're not, or insist that you're not.
The thing that we quarreled about at first was something I uncovered in just reading too much Jefferson, is that he talks about praying.
Yeah,
not just in a conventional way. And so one of the things we talked about, what kind of prayer? And I remember, I will always remember, when you said, what do you mean prayer? She just couldn't, I can't for that matter, put her down on his knees and, intercede.
Well,
God.
You got to get the painting like Washington's.
But he did that, right? No. That was it. What did prayer mean? Yeah. And if you unpack it as historians say, I mean, prayers can be numbers. It's a hope. Mm-hmm. It's an expression of faith. It's a wish for something. And that hopefulness is part and parcel of his optimism. And this is partly an expression of it. Yeah. And so he does use that term. So it's legitimate to think this way.
I'm not going to claim there are lots of times he talks about this. But when he does, the context is he's worried, for instance, about the Madison administration. Mm-hmm. I pray, he says in one letter, that you will love each other as we did, and carry on the good work. I think the key thing about prayer is a hope based on his deep faith in the future, in the project, that the next generation will come through. It's as if he were in a liminal place, almost dead, which is why I identify with him. and prayer is his way of ascending thoughts and wishes and prayers back to those who succeed him, the living generation.
Mm-hmm.
So that I think is another one of the key links between his ideas, his highfalutin ideas about the earth belongs to the living, and the lived reality of the passage of generations. This is really engages him. He sees himself as leaving the stage.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the empire of his imagination is ending.
Yeah.
Right.
All the things that he hopes for the country, all the things he hopes for the world.
Yeah. He doesn't ever become a pro-slavery Virginian, which is something that the next generation will do.
Mm-hmm.
And they use the Bible, they use the Old Testament to justify.
Oh yeah.
When I think most blessed of the patriarchs, I think the Bible. I think the patriarchs of old. I think William Byrd another Virginian talking about how he's self-sufficient under his vine and fig, and he's like the most blessed of the patriarchs. I mean, so is Jefferson newly imagining? So I think of that as an old-fashioned Virginian way. I mean, even in Jefferson's time, an older way of thinking about who these guys self-fashioned themselves to be. But do you see it? So is Jefferson in a continuity with Byrd, or is he taking it a different way entirely?
Byrd is a different character.
That's the next book
of a different feather.
It's a different feather. It's a different feather. Different character.
Yeah.
I mean, his understand by the time he's talking about most blessed of the patriarchs, seeing himself in that way, he's back from France, and he has a new idea about how he's going to be a patriarch. I mean, Byrd, you know, made someone drink a, you know,
a pint of piss.
For, I mean, that isn't,
well, and
for
punishing.
That's not a Jefferson thing.
This is kind of an autarky, self-sufficiency. This is my world. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Jefferson's in the world.
He's in the world, yeah, and he sees himself acting, you know, he is active now in maybe what he thinks. Again, we're saying this is his understanding of himself as changing the way he does the plantation, changing systems of punishment, even though people still get punished the old way. I mean, his overseers do it. His directions to them, what he's telling them to do.
Amelioration
is his idea. So he's a patriarch, but it's a patriarch. It's the patriarch. It's the beginning of the sort of antebellum notion of a paternalistic owner, whatever. Mm-hmm. But I think that's different than Byrd, who's asserting, you know, absolute control like unlimited power. The people who do the kinds of things that he did.
In Byrd's context, well, he's separating himself entirely from any authority outside.
He's out of control.
Whereas Jefferson's still a Republican.
Right. Yeah.
In a Republican.
Yeah, that, exactly.
Yeah.
That amelioration is a key word. Mm-hmm. And as we have often said in conversations, if you can make things better, which you, as a steward, having that kind of natural responsibility for dependents, need to do. Well, and how about a little bit better than that, and even better, then maybe slavery's not that bad.
Yeah.
And that would be the pro-slavery temptation of under a regime of amelioration, because that can lead in different directions.
Absolutely. It makes it easier to be in that state. And he can think at that moment, he's not, you know, seeing slavery as a state of war, which, you know, Peter's written about before.
That's right. It's taking quotes out of context, usual.
Yeah.
The state of war.
What's that, 1780?
You want a state of war, buddy?
You want a state of war, we get a state of war.
Give you a state.
You know, he comes back from France, and he feels that he can do this well, which is, of course, death to any kind of notion that you're going to make a change. Because then you say, well, it is the next generation to do it. While I'm here, I'm going to do this okay. The other people are going to come and they're going to make a change, but we're not thinking of them.
And by the end of his life, it's not going to happen even in the next generation. Mm-hmm. He says, well, before time ends, something like that, roughly speaking. Yeah. In other words, hundreds of generations of enslaved people will remain in bondage.
Mm-hmm. So it's a brilliant book. What are you surprised at any the reception it's been getting? It's been a really strong positive reception from what I've seen. But all the reviewers seem to pull different aspects.
Yeah, it's
that.
Funny. It's very strange. There's no one thing. I mean, there are people who think we hate Jefferson.
Yeah.
Then I saw somewhere described us as our determined defense of him or something. Yeah. Our game defense of him.
This is the divided mind of Publius problem.
I mean, you know. And then the one person said it's all about slavery. And, and then...
They read the first 5 pages.
Yeah, they read the first 5 pages of it. Well, what I figured out what it is that slavery is sort of interwoven through all of the chapters, and there's no one chapter that says slavery, so that you can skip. And you can skip and go on to the other stuff. So they're probably surprised. I thought I was through that. You know, and you get... And there they are again, those pesky slaves.
Yeah.
But, you know, it hasn't been uniform, but they've been good. Mm-hmm. Most of all, we've only had a couple of, you know...
How did you all work together as a team crafting this thing? What was your method? What was your madness? How did it work?
Well, I'd say the method, and this is going to sound awfully sentimental to you, Doug, is is friendship.
Wait, let me get a Kleenex.
Yeah.
Tear up.
Yes.
Let the record reflect.
Do you need one also?
Doug has a handkerchief.
It's a little mystical to say it, but we've been good friends for a long time. Mm. And we started seriously talking maybe 6 years ago, 5 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And in the early phases, two things happened. One, we Skyped a lot and on a regular basis.
Mm-hmm.
And
I
then
find that's a great way to collaborate, the Skype, actually.
Terrific.
And much better than the phone for some reason.
No,
I don't know why.
Well. And then we at various points, we went on the road. We had a pre-writing book launch before the book even existed.
That's
and much existed. We were out there pitching it.
Yeah.
So I think in a way, then the mechanics had to do with how we generated it in the context of, especially Annette's very busy life. I'm retired nearly
so
dead.
Lazy.
Yeah.
So unbelievably lazy.
And then it was just passing chapters back and forth.
You know, sections and things and rewriting and then talking and coming to agreement about various stuff. You know, deciding what it is we wanted to do. Mm-hmm. So it was pretty organic thing. Once we got the basic structure together, and we're not going, you know, chronologically. We're going roughly. There's a rough chronology to it, but not, you know, it was flexible enough to sort of just talk and say we want to do this, we want to try this.
We did an early draft of that.
Who was the taskmaster? I mean, somebody had to be like, we got to get this chapter done by this month, or else this is never going to happen.
I think he was more than that, because there were stretches of time where I just kind of got, you know, I had classes, or and I was in England.
Mm. The Harmsworth professor.
Yeah, we did that, and he was too at one point, but he did it before we started this book, so that was easier. Yeah, it's somewhat easier. But there were points of time when he was at the beginning, and then I kind of got unfair near the end, because once I really turned my attention to it, then it was like, okay, now we got to get going. And he was like,
that was a little
rough. It was like, wait a minute.
Please, where were you all these years?
What was this? Okay,
now
we're
going to
get this
thing. Turn it up.
Okay, now I'm ready. So we got to get rolling. But it was fun. For the most part, it was fun. For the most part, except when I was being, you know, really, you know, overly hard about writing things together at the end there.
Historians collaborate all the time in different ways, but they rarely like write monographic studies together. This is really exciting to see, particularly, I think, two people who are, you know, at the top of their game. Who, you know, history is a cumulative thing. You learn more, you know, and you can write better things. And you guys are, you know, you've been doing this both a long time, and this is nothing about your impending death, Peter, but it's, but it's exciting to see senior people, I think.
It's great too, because this is not something you just said. We do collaborate. Historians collaborate, but it's a more an unusual thing. Nothing like this, and it's much more. It's like what scientists, what they're trying to get everybody to do in a way to model that. I don't know that we want to do this all the time, but I think it's
ever again.
No, of course not. No, but I mean, but it's a great thing to have an intellectual historian who's looked at Jefferson from one set of reading materials, and me from another.
Exactly.
And it would take, we could do this but it would take three times as long to do it.
I think it requires a couple of things. One is you got to be modest about what you can do yourself by yourself.
Yeah.
I think both of us have that sense.
Yeah.
I think that's really
hard. The other is seemingly the opposite, to be very confident in your own expertise and your comfort zone.
Mm-hmm.
And then in that area, the common ground where you're overlapping, that's the important part.
Mm-hmm.
That's where the voices come together.
Mm-hmm.
And it's basically, and I've collaborated a lot, it's you've got to be open to what the other person is doing. And and it's hard for, it's we're the last of the petty bourgeois. we have the illusion that we have our own shops.
Mm-hmm.
And it's pathetic in some ways.
Yeah.
Well, law professors do have their own shops. Go ahead.
Well, but when you collaborate, you also have to be willing to say, "I hate that sentence that you just wrote. That's awful." I mean, you have to be able to say.
No,
that
you don't have
said,
to
right?
say that. No.
You just make a face.
Just rewrite it.
You just rewrite it.
Just silently change this.
Silently change this. It's perfect.
It's good.
Don't look. It's
Don't worry. It's fine. It's perfect.
Well, I challenge everyone listening to this conversation to go through the book and try to pick out Peter and Annette's disagreements. It'll be lots of fun. But anyway, congratulations on the work and good luck with it as it goes on. I look forward to hearing your conversation later today, and thanks for being here with me.
Oh, cool.
This is great. Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
We hope you enjoyed this week's discussion. The Washington Library looks forward to continuing these conversations about our early American history. Please visit mountvernon.org/library to learn more about the library's resources and programs. And remember, Mount Vernon is open 365 days a year and looks forward to welcoming you. Thank you, and we'll see you next week.